Good evening. Just want to thank you all for coming out on during such a busy season. So, I guess, is Father Lomnitzer here? Maybe we can start by saying a prayer to the patroness of our parish. So we'll just say the Hail Mary together. In the name of the Father, and Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen. So tonight is the, my name is Steve Lee, and I'm delighted to be here to introduce our featured speaker. Tonight is the second of a fantastic lineup that Monsignor Royal has put together. So let me quickly introduce Robert Royal. Robert Royal is the founder and president of the Faith and Reason Institute in Washington, D.C., and the editor-in-chief of The Catholic Thing, which is a daily online publication that is translated actually into five different languages. It's a fantastic daily read. Dr. Royal writes and speaks regularly on questions of ethics, culture, religion, and politics. He's appeared frequently on EWTN as a special commentator on church matters and has lectured in 15 countries. He is the author of at least a dozen books, including the subject of tonight's discussion, which is The Catholic Martyrs of the 20th Century. Dr. Royal holds a bachelor's and a master's from Brown University and a PhD in comparative literature from the Catholic University of America. He has taught at Brown, Rhode Island College, and Catholic U. He's received fellowships to study in Italy from the Renaissance Society of America and as a Fulbright scholar. And closer to home for us, he is the brother of our beloved pastor, Monsignor Royal. So, Robert Royal, it is a privilege and an honor to have you here at St. Mary's. Thank you for coming.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. It's not often I get to speak at a place that is being run by someone that I've known for a long time, although he's been rather quiet lately, haven't you noticed that? But I also like speaking in parishes and in small groups because, frankly, at this point in our history where the church and the world are in turmoil, I really deeply believe, and I think the witness of the martyrs actually confirms this, that what we're going to preserve and what we're going to advance in the world is largely going to pass through smaller groups. Pope Benedict XVI used to talk about the fact that history is always made by creative minorities. And that's why when we get together as Catholics, even just as Americans, in smaller groups and try to do things like this, it can have an enormous impact. It's impossible, as you'll hear when I begin to talk about the martyrs, it's impossible to neglect the large-scale political and economic and military currents that are going on at any given time. But all that comes and goes. What really stays is God and the faithful witnesses to God, whether they're martyrs or confessors or something else. And I want to emphasize that spiritual dimension about what we're going to talk about, because otherwise you might get the impression that all we're going to be talking about is how some people killed other people. And that's not at all what's going on. So just to begin, let me explain to you how I got involved in all of this. It's owing largely to Carol Pinard, who's here with her husband, Bob, this evening, and to the Monsignor, and to another Monsignor, Monsignor Peter Cullen, who may be known to a bunch of you, who at the time were at St. Aloysius. Talk about making a difference through parish activity. And Carol began receiving and collecting and ordering all sorts of materials about martyrs and people who've been persecuted. And as this stuff started to pour in, it became clear at one point that, you know, what do we do with all this stuff? And so someone, probably Monsignor Royal, called me and said, what do we do? And I said, you know, we probably need a book about this. Now, the odd thing is the church used to, and church-related publishers used to follow a lot of the cases of persecution and martyrdom, and is beginning to do that again. But it kind of dropped off around the time of Vatican II. I think partly because Vatican II didn't want to challenge the Soviets. It wanted to get into a dialogue with the Soviets. And so to bring up the way the church had done earlier, the clash, the ideological clash between communism and the faith wouldn't advance that dialogue. Now, that's a very difficult dialogue. And as I'm going to try to make you see as we go through some of these cases, in some ways, that kind of progressive, socialist, communist, and I'm sad to say even certain currents in our own culture, are simply irreconcilable with Christianity. There used to be a time, at least here in America, where we thought we could live and let live. But I'm afraid that time is sort of slipping away unless some of us recognize what's happening and try to do something about it. So from that, you know, that kind of local parish beginning, we got the book written through miraculous interventions of financial and practical matters. I went over to Rome a couple of times to the Commission on New Martyrs. If you've ever been to Rome, there's an island in the Tiber, and the Church of St. Bartholomew is on that island, and in the basement is the Commission on New Martyrs there. The idea of the New Martyrs is something that John Paul II emphasized right before the new millennium. And he didn't mean by that only recent martyrs. I'll explain a little bit in a minute what that meant. But the point he was trying to make is that the witness of the martyrs in the 20th century is an important part of Christianity, yes, but also of the secular history of the 20th century. And actually, when my book came out, my book was published by Herder and Herder Crossroad in New York, and then it was translated into several languages, and so it kind of got everywhere for a while. I actually convinced the editor of the Washington Post Book World, who I'd written for a couple of times, she'd asked me to review a couple of books. I said to her, you've got to review my book, not because, for your purposes, so much for the Catholicism, as that this is a missing element of the secular history of the 20th century. If you don't know that people were being killed in the 20th century for their faith, not just because they were in countries that were warring with one another, but for their faith, because of ideological opposition to Christianity, then you don't have a faithful portrait of what actually happened in the 20th century. Now, unfortunately, the editor assigned my book to a young woman who is not very familiar with either 20th century history or history of religion. And if you can believe this, in her review, she said, Royal doesn't seem to understand that Catholics just happen to be in the wrong countries in the 20th century. Can you imagine? It's like saying Jews don't seem to understand that they just happen to be in Germany. It wasn't the right country for them to be in, you know? So anyway, my brother and I got to know Archbishop Basil Hrinchin, who was a Canadian of Ukrainian background, and he was also the Eparch of Northern Europe, and he helped us out. And so on May 7, 2000, which was about only 1 year from the time that I resigned from Ethics and Public Policy Center, which was my previous perch, it was almost exactly 1 year to the day that I left and began writing the book, that we gave a copy of the book to John Paul II after his early morning mass in Rome. And that was the same day that in that evening over at the Colosseum, he had a special kind of liturgy, celebration, memorial for all the Christian martyrs, not just the Catholic martyrs, but the Orthodox, the Protestants, et cetera, of the 20th century. One of the most moving things that we've been to, and I think Carol probably remembers that as well. I gave a bunch of lectures on the martyrs after my book came out. And Aid of the Church in Need, USA, has just asked me to do a second volume. We were going to do a rewrite of the first volume, but the more I looked at it, it just seemed smarter and easier to write a second volume. So I'm going to be bringing things up to date from what we knew of the scholarly literature 20 years ago, but then also what's happened in the 21st century, because martyrdom, as you know, is not going away in the 21st century either. We look around the world and there are all sorts of things happening in Africa, Asia, in China, in Vietnam, Korea, et cetera. This is a constant because there is this constant clash between one view of human beings and another. I'm teaching. Somebody came up to me and said he's taking my course on the city of God. Well, Augustine, for those of you who've read that book or know about that book, says that there is a city of God and there's a city of man. And the city of man tries to exist without God. And preeminently in our time, it's been the ideological regimes, the communists, the Nazis, the fascists, et cetera, who've tried to exist without God. And inevitably, the two worlds are going to clash. But I just bring up that history because I wanted to mention to you something that very funny that happened. That kind of I keep trying to account for myself what attracted me to the martyrs when Carol had assembled all this material. Now, on the one hand, it's just a cool thing to think about people who are willing to give up their lives for their faith, right? Greater love than this, no man hath, than he gives up his life for his friends. And of course, it's following Jesus and giving up your life to the very end. But in another way, after one of my lectures, a woman stood up, and I think I mentioned this in the promotional video, and she said to me, "Weren't you ever depressed reading all that material about how awfully people were tortured and, you know, imprisoned and then killed and butchered?" And when she said this, I have to say, it really took me aback because it had never crossed my mind. That in fact, I said this spontaneously to her, I said, I've never spent so much time with so many good, holy, and forgiving people. I mean, almost to the point of at the moment, like Christ, when they're being killed, saying, "God, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do." And so if I had to look into myself why I got interested in this and why I'm still fascinated by the martyrs, it's that. It's just this utter ability to, as many of the early Christian martyrs lived their lives at, this other ability to die in great peace and confidence with God, and yet not to be the way most people in a society would be, angry and resentful towards the people who are killing them. It's one of the miracles of grace in the world. Now, that said, I want to turn a little bit now to the martyrs themselves. You know, we hear a lot in modern democratic societies how it's people who cling to guns and religion and, you know, people who are shunning science and facts and are biased are responsible or potentially responsible for a lot of violence in the world. In fact, I would argue, some of you may want to challenge me about this, I would argue the exact opposite. That at least the ones that I've documented, it's precisely their religious dimension and their willingness to defend what is right and what is good and what is true, and to accept science, facts, all that, and understand the context they're in. They are the very ones who did not perpetrate large-scale violence in the world. They're the ones who were the victims of that violence. And like most untruths that get told in society, it tends to be the exact opposite of what we hear in public debates. And the closer you look at what actually happened is you start to see something that, again, I see reflected happening in our society that worries me a great deal, is that the revolution or the liberation or whatever the ideological program that is of the city of man is coming forward, whatever that is, trumps all the normal moralities. So it's not any big deal for a fascist or a Nazi or a communist to kill vast numbers of people for the sake of revolution. Just as we cancel people these days because they're not politically correct or woke or whatever the thing happens to be. Now, I don't want to overstate that, but I don't want to understate it either, that you can see something that's creeping here that has the potential to do a great deal of harm. And what eventually happens if it's allowed to be unchecked, is precisely the kind of thing that the martyrs experienced. Now, I mentioned how this poor woman who reviewed my book in the Washington Post Book World thought that Catholics were in the wrong, just happened to be in the wrong countries. We know. I mean, we know from solid historical records that Hitler said he would crush the church like a toad. Stalin joked about how many divisions does the Pope have, you know, and he suppressed the Ukrainian Catholic Church. During the Spanish Civil War, which is 1936 to 1939, the Republicans, who actually drew into their circle of support people like Hemingway and George Orwell and even Jacques Maritain, probably the greatest Catholic philosopher of the 20th century, they wanted to be on the side of what they thought was a democratic movement. But the Republicans, I'll detail this in a minute, but they slaughtered whole classes of people, whole convents, whole seminaries, whole dioceses, whole groups of priests, convents. In the 20th century, for the first time in Europe, since ancient Rome, defenseless Christians, and quite often priests, were killed by wild animals. In the Spanish bull rings, they would put priests in there and bring in wild bulls, and then when they were killed, many of you probably know that there's a tradition in Spain that when you kill a bull, you cut his ear off, and that's kind of a trophy. Well, they would cut the ear off the priest. This is not kid stuff. This is brutal stuff that comes out of a certain ideology. There was brutal brainwashing of seminarians in communist Romania. Governments in Vietnam, North Korea, China, Africa abuse and continue to abuse independent believers because even in the 21st century, they find that Christianity is, yes, it's a religion of peace and of order, but it's also in a way for the city of man that wants to live without God and wants to make up its own rules. It's also, Christianity is also in a way a revolutionary regime. Now, secular journalists, when they actually come across one of these cases that I've been describing, they almost always try to make it about economics and politics. And look, I'm quite aware that every circumstance is complicated. If you want to know why the persecutions in Spain were so brutal, you have to, of course, understand European history at that moment and the whole history of Spain and whatnot. Still, at the end of the day, some people are dead and other people are not. And the people who are dead are not guilty in any normal sense of guilty of things that we would think are worthy of execution. And so what begins to be regarded as rational in public, in ideological regimes, ends up as a murderous thing. Whereas in the Christian dispensation, rational means, you know, looking at things, being tolerant towards people, and also allowing that given that the world is fallen, we're not going to create utopias, and therefore we're somewhat tolerant of one another, we're merciful toward one another, we're forgiving toward one another. And if you haven't noticed, a lot of that has been disappearing from our public life these days. In the 20th century, a lot of what counted as rational was built along things that some people among us these days think are quite useful. Nazism is built on racism. Evil, awful racism. But it emphasized race in order to divide the human race. Communism was built on the dictatorship of the proletariat. It sought to divide people by class. And now we've, in our great wisdom in the West, introduced gender. So you have race, class, and gender, which are the unholy trinity now that everybody is supposed to oppose. But in fact, these categories are making things more and more troubled because our understanding as Christians is that we're all part of one family. Church has always taught that there can't be a legitimate class struggle. There can be, you know, different economic interests. There can't be a class struggle because we're all of the same class. We're human beings. We're sons and daughters of God. And similarly, there can't be a race struggle, even though there are racial tensions in the world, because we are all of the same race, the human race, again, sons and daughters of God. And about gender, that's another lecture that would take me forever to talk about. But while these things are being discussed, the church is often portrayed as if we're back in the 12th century or the 17th century, and that in the most, you know, the worst interpretation of what those centuries actually mean. Whereas if you just look objectively at what happened in the 20th century towards different classes of people, meaning primarily religious people, you're utterly astonished that the large numbers of people who were destroyed, not only in the Holocaust, not only Jews, but Christians and others, has gone unnoticed by the public realm, right? The church takes care of more sick people than any other private institution in the world. It hangs around after disasters in places like Haiti or when there's an earthquake or something. And yet, the church throughout our secular culture is regarded as evil because it opposes some of the shibboleths that we have tried to impose on ourselves, right? And as we see in America, when the media kind of stir up some question about the way the church has handled schools in Canada or may have influenced the repeal of Roe versus Wade, churches start to burn and pro-life institutions start to get vandalized and even individual Catholics get attacked. Richard Dawkins, who's one of the most famous new atheists, taught it many years at Oxford. He was the professor of the public understanding of science and a Darwinist. In his later years, he moved to Cambridge. I think he's emeritus now. But he once said, and I think this is where it all comes down to in the end, and we're seeing more and more of this. He once said that teaching children, bringing children up, a religious upbringing of children should be regarded as child abuse. Now, I don't know Richard Dawkins, and other than teaching at Oxford, I don't know that he's ever done any children any good. But I know that the church has done children a lot of good by promoting families, by running orphanages, by all the different things that we know are necessary to have a good society. Now, some people have claimed, and some people have claimed that I've claimed, although I haven't, that there are more Christian martyrs in the 20th century than all the previous centuries combined. I'm not going to say that that's not true, because we don't have great records, particularly in Africa, where you have troubled regimes and they want to hide things. When I went to the Commission on New Martyrs in Rome back in the day in 1999, there were 13,000 files of martyrs that they had there. 9,000 of them were from Spain. And the reason was the conflict in Spain was brief. Spain kept good records. So, you know, the different religious orders and the different dioceses knew actually who got killed. But it wasn't that Spain was particularly bad. It's one of the paradoxes about trying to trace the martyrs is the worse the regime is, and probably the higher the body counts are, the more difficult it is to find out actually what happened. And that's truly the case in much of Africa. There was a tiny bit of material. I had to kind of dig the stuff out and talk with people. And so that's something to keep in mind as we go through some of these cases, of course. But I want to talk about some specific cases, and then I'd be happy to take some of your questions and comments. The first group of new martyrs I want to talk about is from a country that you might not expect. It's the otherwise deeply Catholic and neighboring nation of Mexico. How many of you know that there was a repression in Mexico in the 20th century of the church? Yeah, there are quite a few of you. I mean, in an educated audience like this, you probably, you know, you could come across that somewhere. But most people don't know that. that the Mexican government was one of the first to become an aggressively socialist regime. And, you know, if you wanted to do some intellectual history, you could go back to the French Revolution and the Enlightenment, and again, this establishment of a kind of a secular realm that's going to be separate from the sacred realm. But in Mexico, it took a particularly murderous form. And we've got, yeah, there it is. The Mexican government thought that it was going to be able to crush the church, close churches, ban masses, made priestly activity of hearing confessions and giving communion and whatnot illegal. If you want a good account of this, Graham Greene, the novelist, has written a novel called The Power and the Glory. And then he also has a kind of a documentary, because he happened to be in Mexico around the time that all this happened. It's called The Lawless Roads. It actually has a couple of different titles, but that's the one I think that it's published under here in the United States. There's also a good movie about the Cristero Rebellion, the rebellion of lay people who actually went to war, about 300,000 of them, against the government because of this. But Miguel Pro, I want to just talk about Miguel Pro because he's a kind of an icon of the Mexican problem. Pro was a Jesuit. He actually studied, he got thrown out of the country, so he studied at Los Gatos in California, which is one of the Jesuit seminaries. And then he went to Spain and he studied, and he came back into Mexico surreptitiously, almost miraculously, because he had priestly stuff in his bags and somehow the inspectors didn't see it when he came in. And so he began to operate in Mexico City. And his Jesuit superior said to him, "Be careful. People need a priest, so don't get arrested unnecessarily. But at the same time, you have to make sure that you show up when there's a communion station or a confession station. Otherwise, people won't come back for these sacraments." And so he negotiated this. And some people sometimes ask me, who's your favorite of the martyrs? They're all my favorites. I love all of them because they're different in the various ways. But Pro was one of these cut-ups. You know, he was the kind of guy who would deal with these skits. And some of his fellow seminarians at Los Gatos said after the fact, if you asked us who would have ended up a martyr and a saint, he would have been pretty far down the list, you know, because he would do this stuff in the dining hall and whatnot. But he was able to act. So if he went to see a group of society women, he would dress up as a dandy, you know, with a straw hat and whatnot. If he went had to go to, you know, where mechanics were working, he'd put on overalls, greasy overalls, and he'd go in there. He'd look like he was just a mechanic. But my favorite story about him is that he once went up to a communion station, which was in a private home. And there were two plainclothes detectives outside. And so he's remembering he should not get arrested, but at the same time he has to show up. So what he does is, this is divine grace, he flips his lapel as if he's got a lieutenant's badge there. Of course, there's nothing underneath there. He says, "What's going on, men?" And they said, "We think there's a pigeon in there," meaning a priest. And he says, "Stay here, I'll check." So he goes in, he distributes communion. He comes out and they said, "Well?" He says, "False alarm, stand down, man." How you get away with this, I don't know, but it's God's humor, right? It's God's humor and his grace. But Pro was eventually captured. He was sentenced to death. And the then Mexican president, Plutarco Elias Calles, who was one of the most rabidly anti-Catholic presidents of Mexico, sentenced him to death and invited the world press to come watch him be shot. And he thought that what would happen is Pro would break down, he would cry for mercy, and they would see how hypocritical the clergy were in Mexico. That was a bad calculation on the president's part, because Pro went in calmly, like the early martyrs, knelt down, said a prayer, put his arms out in the shape of the cross, and said, neither defiantly nor overly humble, he said, "Viva Cristo Rey," long live Christ the King. And of course he gets executed. Now, Calles after this says, well, you know, these pictures should not be published, but you know, you've got photographers, they go all over the world. He instantly becomes a cause célèbre. It's an embarrassment to the United States because we've been playing footsie with the Mexican government a little bit. His body is taken to his father's house, and his father must have been a great man too, because he told people, let us not mourn, because there is nothing to mourn about in this way of dying for God. And when the pallbearers came and took his body out in the casket and began to walk to take him to be buried, 20,000 people were outside the house, and they all began to chant, Viva Cristo Rey. If you don't think that makes a difference in a society. I want to talk about Spain a little bit, because Spain had some of the same problems of sort of this, you know, this secular ideology that was warring with the Catholic vision of things. As most of you probably know, in Spain, there was a civil war in 1936-1939. The Republicans were, you know, allegedly a democratic movement, but were really very close to the Soviet Union and had a strong communist socialist element behind them. The nationalists associated with Francisco Franco, who often is described as a fascist, I don't think that's quite right. I think that the scholars who have looked at this say that he made some alliances with the fascists because he had to get planes and other things. He wasn't really ideological. He was just a man who, in fact, he wasn't a leader until the whole thing started to collapse in Spain, and he was a general in North Africa and came back and just by accident. It wasn't a plan. It wasn't a movement. He became the leader of the resistance against the Republicans. But here's the thing that brings me, I mean, you could debate, you know, which side was the better side. And if a figure like Jacques Maritain at the time was moved to support the Republican side, for me, it tells you something. Hemingway kind of supported them. George Orwell kind of supported them. And a figure like Jacques Maritain. So there were these international brigades, idealists who went to Spain to fight and whatnot. But no Western country supported the Republicans. And it's primarily because of their repression of religion. Now, again, if you want to impose a kind of a more secular democratic regime, okay, that's something that can be decided in a political circumstance. But let me just read you some numbers and see what you think of this. At least 6,832 priests and religious were martyred in Spain, and 13 bishops. This is a three-year war, 36 to 39, and basically the violence of the war was only the first 6 months, because by then the nationalist forces had kind of pacified various places. So in 6 months, basically, over almost 7,000 priests, 13 bishops. I think there were one or two bishops who escaped because they happened to be out of the country when this whole thing started. But otherwise, all of them stayed and died, which to me is a testimony, again, to the, you know, the claims that are often made about the church, that people are hypocritical, you know, they're living easy lives as priests and bishops and whatnot. When it came right down to it, these people stayed and they died as witnesses to Christ. Just a few more numbers. Male religious martyred, 259 Claretians, 256 Franciscans, 204 Pietists, 176 Brothers of Mary, 165 Christian Brothers, 155 Augustinians, 132 Dominicans, and 114 Jesuits. Among the female orders, 30 Daughters of Charity. Now, you know, these women were not political at all. They're in convents, you know, they're taking care of people and praying. 26 Carmelites, 26 Adoratrices, 20 Capuchins, and on and on and on. And that's why when I went to the Commission on New Martyrs, there were 9,000 files about people who were potentially candidates for martyrdom, and we have the greatest records there of any place else on earth where martyrdom took place. I'm going to have to move quickly now through some of this material, but just to touch, because my book tries to touch, I mean, you can't write a whole history of what martyrdom was like in the 20th century, because you could write whole books even on just China these days, or you write whole books on Africa these days. But I want to talk about the Nazi martyrs for a bit, because Actually, one thing I will stand behind, I don't know if the number of martyrs was larger than all the previous martyrs combined, but I do know that the largest number of martyrs in the 20th century were produced by communism, which is something that lots of people have criticized me about, but I think that's just the case. There are some sort of security state martyrdoms, like Archbishop Romero in Salvador, now a saint. There were American churchwomen who were killed down in El Salvador. There were Jesuits killed in Nicaragua, and a bishop in Guatemala. But compared to what the communists did in a systematic way, the security states are really kind of small potatoes. And I think we just have to acknowledge that and say, what does this tell us? But the other large element of martyrdom in the 20th century, of course, is the Nazis. The Nazis killed 6 million Jews. That figure is debated. Probably 6 million Poles too, along the way, one way or another. We know the great stories of Maximilian Kolbe, Edith Stein, Father Jerzy Popiełuszko, kind of later on than after World War II. But the one story I want to just tell you about is a person called Franz Jägerstätter. Do we have you don't have anything by him here now. No, that's too bad. Jägerstätter was a layman. And I've talked a lot about priests and bishops and whatnot. Jägerstätter was a simple layman in Austria. There's a rather good movie about him called A Hidden Life. And really worth seeking out. It's well done, and Jägerstätter ends up being murdered by the Nazis just days before the American and Russian forces finally take down the Nazis. So he had to just decide to do that rather than submit, because they were constantly pressuring him. Even his local parish priest pressured him to just kind of fall into line and not oppose the Nazis. In fact, what he did is he was a farmer, he even refused the relief efforts that the government wanted to give to farmers when I guess there was a bad harvest or something. And he had three or four children, and he refused that because he wanted nothing to do with the regime. He stopped going to the local tavern because he kept getting into fights over Nazism. He was the sexton at his church, and just a simple farmer began reading into the depths of Catholicism. And so one detail that's always struck me is when he got to prison, the Nazi prison, he was delighted to find that there was a volume of St. John Chrysostom's sermons in the prison library. Not exactly, diverting reading for most of us, but he was that kind of guy. A simple farmer had got himself to that point. Anyway, this is another example of how just pure holiness resisted one of the worst military and ideological juggernauts in the 20th century. When we hear, I'm getting excited now. We hear a lot about the Nazi persecution of Jews, and we should pay attention to that because it was horrifying. But there was a lot of anti-Christian stuff that happened too. I owe my own wife to Adolf Hitler, because, let me explain. My wife is half Russian, half Ukrainian. Her mother and father, who were both Christians, were picked up by the Nazis toward the end of the war. They would bring Slavs to the work camps so the maximum number of men could go out and fight in the fields. And so my mother-in-law and father-in-law met in a Nazi work camp. And then they escaped into France. They didn't want to go back to the Soviet Union when the Third Reich collapsed. So they escaped into France, got married. Wife was born there, and then they came to the United States. So there are these stories about Catholics and Christians that we need to be telling. We need to be learning about, and we need to be telling, because they tell us something about the type of culture overall that we're living in. Just very quickly, because I know I'm getting a little short on time here, let me just talk in some broad terms about some of the other Eastern martyrs. There's a wonderful case of a bishop, Theodor Romja, who was an Eastern Rite Catholic in Ukraine. Now, we're all thinking about Ukraine these days and the divisions, the Catholics and the Orthodox, who are part of the Moscow Patriarchate and those who are part of the Ukrainian Patriarchate. But Romja was a fearless young bishop, a great preacher. And of course, he was coming back from the consecration of a church with two of his priests in some rural area once. And the communists came in, tried to kill him with rifle butts. The farmers all came out and stopped it, took him to a hospital. And while he was in a hospital, a communist KGB agent, a nurse, she comes in and administers poison and killed him. And you say to yourself, you know, why would they do this about a young bishop, right? But this guy, like the Mincentis and the Vyshinskis and the Slippies and many others, was utterly fearless. So he would go out and declare a holy pilgrimage and 80,000 people would show up at a city. He did that one time and the communists decided that's not going to happen again. So they posited their own festival of, I don't know, socialism probably at the same place. 4,000 people showed up. And Romja had another one in a different city, and 80,000 showed up elsewhere. So the gospel moves people. It's moved people throughout history. And a guy like that, for a regime that wants no resistance, and there are many of them, sometimes it's not ideological. Sometimes it's just, you know, someone who is a dictator, like Idi Amin in Uganda, just decimated religious resistance to his regime. But you see this not only in Ukraine, you saw it in the Soviets brought that into Eastern Europe. There are a million horrifying stories about Romania, Slovakia, Bulgaria, et cetera. They're all in my book. And yet the flip side of those stories is that the church endured. The Ukrainian Catholic Church in particular was the largest suppressed church. It was forced to become part of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. And the minute communism disappeared, this church popped up out of nowhere. It had been underground. So there can be seeds under the snow. And we must remember that. And it's the martyrs, the people who are willing to keep things alive and risk a lot to keep things alive, are people we owe a great deal to. Well, you know what? I think I'm going to try to just draw this to a close here. I have lots of other material, but I'm sure some of you want to make comments of your own and ask some questions. And let me just say in broad gauge terms what I'm thinking about in the second book. Because, as I said, really the massive numbers of martyrs that occurred in the 20th century were largely the result of ideologies. It was communism, fascism, and Nazism, and a few national security state cases. Or dictators of one sort or another. My impression in the 21st century is that we're seeing something quite different. China is still kind of a communist regime. I mean, we kind of debate how communist is it? It seems to be very capitalist. It doesn't seem to be, you know, classically Marxist. But it cracks down hard on Falun Gong, on the Uyghurs, on Catholics. I'm sorry to say that I think our Vatican made a bad deal in signing that secret agreement with the shycoms, as we used to call them during the Cold War. I've met with a lot of different people in Washington over the 30 years that I've lived down there, and I'm prepared to say that I have never met a more mendacious, slippery, revolting group of people than the Chinese diplomats I had to deal with occasionally. And they're always making excuses. You know, you read stories of how the Chinese have sawn off a cross on a church, or they shut a church down, or, you know, they bulldoze a church. And when you confront these guys and they say, well, you know, what are you doing? You're the religious minister in the Chinese government. And they say, well, you know, some of these rural governors are a little out of hand. We can't. This is the most utter nonsense. This starts at the top and it continues straight through. But the other element of oppression that I see coming in the 21st century is, unfortunately, Islam. You know, ISIS has receded. There have been some other things that have receded. I was just in Israel because some of my kids are in our U.S. State Department, and they've been in the Middle East for a number of years. And, you know, the number of Christians in the Middle East is just evaporating. These are the oldest Christian communities, continuous Christian communities in Syria, in Lebanon, in Jordan, I mean, these, as these countries are now called today, even in Israel. And we were in Bethlehem, and the Christian presence in Bethlehem has been lessened as a result of pressures. So my worry is about those. But I've got to say again, I'm also worried about our own Western situation, because we've seen a much more aggressive, anti-religious, anti-Christian in a classical sense, current begin to emerge in our society. And it's not only here, it's in Europe as well. There's some friends of mine, they're two Americans. They live in Vienna and work day jobs, you know, doing various important things. But they run what they call the Observatory on Christian Persecution in Europe. And what they look at are these specific cases where governments or groups are able to either intimidate or shut down or tell people that they can't demonstrate or tell people that they can't have a religious procession. All those things that we see here, also here in the United States, where the space that's being allowed to religion is shrinking. And religion in and of itself, especially traditional Catholicism, Christianity, Judaism, even not quite Islam yet, because we haven't gotten to that. That's a kind of a crossed wire when you've got to criticize Islam. But we see that all the spaces that traditional religion used to occupy is getting reduced. And in fact, in some ways, the church as sort of the preeminent presence in Western societies of the older religious traditions tends to be regarded as a hate group. I'm not exaggerating when I say this. I see this in Washington, that we're a hate group, we're biased because we have different views. There was a moment in America when we all tried to live and let live, right? We were a tolerant, democratic society. I'm afraid that moment is now past. I said at the beginning, I don't want to exaggerate this part of what's going on, and I hope to God it doesn't lead to where it did lead in the 20th century in various societies. But we cannot be naive about this. We've got to be aware of it. We've got to know exactly what it is when it appears, and we have to respond to it. Then there are different ways to respond to it. It's just wherever you happen to be, you have to find some courage to respond to it. I've been talking a lot lately about the importance of processions and pilgrimages, because I think, you know, we protest, and that's great. We protest against abortion or, you know, for marriage or whatever it might be. But we also need just to be a presence in society. I was just on a pilgrim walk down in Florida last weekend that ends in St. Augustine, Florida, at the shrine of Our Lady of La Leche. And that is a very beautiful thing to do, to be a bunch of Catholics just walking, to be present, thinking spiritually as you're walking along, and end up in a place that has this rich history, the very first place where Catholic Mass was said in North America, in St. Augustine. So I'll leave you with that thought. What I've talked about is largely historical, but it's not only historical. There are things about this that we have to learn from, because they don't go away, and they exist in our own circumstances as well. And if we don't step up to it, we're not being faithful to the very end, the way these great men and women martyrs of the 20th century have shown us real Catholics.